I'll take this moment to give some love to our partners. So my name, I shouldn't introduce myself. My name is Jim Pickett with the International Rectal Microbicide Advocates. We're one of the co-sponsors of this call. We're doing this in alliance with the fabulous folks at the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance, HIV-PGA, and with our stalwart partners, AVAC, who are providing the dial-in capabilities today, the webinar capabilities, helping us with all the background logistics. So thank you very much, AVAC, for that. Thanks, HIV-PGA, for sponsoring this call with us. And thanks to all of you for being on this call today. Just a quick little bit of background about Jeff. He was a respected and passionate sociologist, and he passed away this past February at the age of 49. He was also a gay man living with HIV, and his identity was an important component of the science he conducted. His brilliant human touch research on gay men's sex, sexuality, and various prevention methodologies involving treatment and PrEP was groundbreaking, visionary, and way ahead of most of us, really challenged us and really forced us to look at things in new ways. I know he did that for me, for sure. Jeff was influential on a global scale, and his work has given us and continues to give us powerful insight into social and sexual networks and the importance of love and pleasure, two words that we talk too little about when we're discussing HIV prevention. They're absolutely necessary if we're going to be successful in moving forward. So today we have a bunch of panelists, fabulous folks who both know Jeff or are going to be speaking about some science that Jeff certainly influenced in one way, shape, or form. And we will go through the panelists. Each will have about 10 to 12 minutes to present their talk. We will do clarifying questions after each, but we'll save most of the QA and discussion for the conclusion. We will be hearing memories of Jeff, and we will also be talking about what's happening in terms of new prevention science and policy, and what we can do with these things. So while it's a memorial to Jeff, it's also looking forward and being inspired by his work and inspired by what's happening and what's coming and figuring out what we can do collectively just do a better job. So before we get going with our panelists for today, I want to turn the call over for some remarks from the marvelous, wonderful, one-of-a-kind lead of the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance, Julie Davis.
Well, thanks. Thanks, Jim. Thanks, everybody, for being here. I'm honored that we are able to come together to have this webinar in keeping with Jeff's life and work to bring a creative rigor to our analysis and our priorities. I just wanted to jump in because not only is this a webinar that I'm really proud to be a part of, and I want to speak briefly about how pivotal Jeff has been in the HIV prevention justice movement, but also this is my last webinar while on staff at HIV-PGA. Starting next week, I'm going to be working at thebody.com as their managing editor. And so having been a part of the prevention justice movement as my central work for about 10 years, it feels really moving to me that this will be the final webinar that we'll have while I'm on staff. I met Jeff when he was speaking at a conference. I think it was the retrovirus conference. And I had never heard anyone speak like that before. I've been in HIV advocacy and activism for a really long time. And it was the combination of I'd heard excellent research presentations. I'd heard scientific descriptions that just nailed it, and I'd even heard work that really drew a bridge between the sort of application of social or biomedical sciences and the justice issues that I feel are so pivotal to our fight against HIV. But the way that Jeff brought it together with, honestly, a super fiery activist approach that was confrontational and unrelenting. And at that point, it was being pretty unrelenting about the methodologies being employed by the San Francisco Health Department. It was just a package I hadn't quite seen all in one before. And so from that moment on at that conference, I think my guess is that Jeff probably got cruised at conferences before, maybe not like someone just like me, and for the purpose of taking him out to dinner to grill him, how do you know what you know, what are you working on, what should we do? And from that moment on, I feel like he really opened my eyes to insisting on elevating the level of analysis, particularly of working with people to accurately depict and describe their lives, including in the area of sexually, as they themselves would describe it, and that the jobs of activists and analysts and researchers is to figure out how to use the tools of our trade to bring justice to how we communicate about our practices, other people's practices, and how to work together to get the best public health outcomes. So I just wanted to jump in, and now I'll turn it over to our wonderful panelists, but I just want to take a moment to say that, you know, we'll hear a lot about Jeff today and his work, but I just want to have everyone be crystal clear that he was one of the major sort of methodological thinkers and inspirations for the HIV prevention justice movement. And for that, I want to thank him and to thank all of you for everything that you are doing and for the opportunity to work alongside you on these issues for the last 10 years. That I now will also be helping to expand coverage of at thebody.com starting next week. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Julie. And Julie is going to stick around for the discussion as well. So you have questions for her. I want to pull her in. She'll be with us. So without further ado, I would like to begin with our panel today. We're going to start with Pedro, who's an HIV prevention, communications, and education public health consultant based in San Francisco from Peru, who also worked in communications on the IPREC study and worked closely with Jeff. So, Pedro, are you ready to get started?
Hello, everybody. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Julie. I have to admit that this has been very hard for me. I really want to thank you the opportunity to pay gratitude and tribute to an esteemed and appreciated colleague and a very good friend, Dr. James Jeffrey McConnell. This is Jeff's Facebook page, and I took the liberty to replacing his profile picture in that page with another one he took in Iquitos in Peru when he visited the local Boras etnia in middle of the Peruvian Amazon Basin. I think that picture is the way he would have liked to be always remembered, with the nice smile and expression of happiness he had at that time. He used this picture in most of his presentations and what we call official documents. That's the picture I have in my mind whenever I think about Jeff. To produce this presentation, I went through nearly 1,000 emails that we had in those 10 years that we've met. First one was from March 18th of 2004. And at that time, Jeff was visiting Peru with Bob to talk about this fabulous HIV prevention approach that needed to be tested in men who have sex with men. And Peru was a potential country where we could test this strategy. And then I went through the last email he sent me on August 30th of 2013. And that email said, actually it started in Spanish saying, "Te queremos, Pedro. We love you, Pedro." And that makes reference to a short video we produced to promote the study for recruitment in Peru. And he said, "We were a part of something big, and you showed us how." Puentes. Puentes was the program that we started in Lima, Peru, with Impacta, when we started doing clinical trials. And Puentes was a program that welcomed this PrEP study. It wasn't IFRS yet at that time. When I first met Jeff, was back in 2000. Next slide, please. When I first met Jeff was back in 2004 in Lima. Bob and Jeff were about to talk to the community advisory board at a PrEP study site that's impacted. The previous one. Okay, yeah. And was about to talk to the community advisory board at Impacta, that was a potential study site at that time to do this PrEP study. And so I was helping in the translation. And so after Bob finished his intervention, he said something like, "And now I leave you with my colleague, Jeff McConnell, the sociologist that does the budget." And we love, I mean, I had to translate and I was clueless about this. And then, and from that moment on, that became our private joke. Jeff McConnell, the sociologist that does the budget. And we laughed about that very often. Next slide, please. Jeff was a very, very good friend to us, my partner and I. He always hung out with us. He was always present at birthday parties, and he was a lot of fun. When we first moved to San Francisco, he welcomed us and helped us to settle up in this new city. I still have the table he lent us 6 years ago. It was the first table in our small studio on Market Street. That table is my workstation now. That table is where all the good ideas flow nowadays. And that table keeps Jeff's present life at home with me and my partner. That and all the framed photographs he gave to us in very special occasions. He loved photography, and he was always taking pictures. And in any special occasion, he brought some framed pictures to us, and so we were hanging those pictures, and we have those pictures hung at home in one of the tables, on the walls. And I remember once he said, "You probably have the largest display of my own photograph in your home than what I have in my own home." Next slide, please. PrEP was controversial at those times, and so was Jeff. He was an activist and an advocate of HIV prevention. He had a vision, and that vision finally turned into reality. He had the vision that PrEP was going to be successful only with the support from the community. The vision that gay men and trans women were going to have a new HIV prevention strategy to use by choice. The vision that scientists should understand sex behaviors from the perspective that sexually is diverse and pleasurable. We had countless discussions accompanied by Long Island iced tea cocktails at the Long Star, a little bar at the South of Market in San Francisco. Oh yes, we were going to solve the problems of the world. We foresaw a world where sex was enjoyed with no guilt, and most of all, with no HIV or STIs, and another round of cocktails. I remember one particular conversation we had about circumcision and HIV prevention in gay men and the possibility of designing a trial to prove efficacy of that intervention. This was at Lone Star Bar after third round of Long Island iced tea. Jeff said, "How are we going to let the guys to go through such a mutilation? What a waste. We should give them PrEP." Next slide, please. IPREX meant a lot to him. The successful results of the trial, the CDC preliminary guidelines, the FDA approval of PrEP as an HIV prevention tool, and the combination of the open label patient is the real and true tribute to Jeff's vision, enthusiasm, commitment, and beliefs. We love him about the time when the last Hypersolid study participant was having his last visit in Peru, where all this prep adventure started, a country and people for which Jeff felt so much. Next slide, please. We co-authored several abstracts and traveled a lot together. He was always the spirit of the trips, and when we traveled, we discovered the new cities and that we were visiting, and of course, trying new cocktails from the cities. Next slide, please. And yes, we had very good times with very good friends wherever we went. Next slide, please. Jeff was a loner. The latter days in Jeff's life were hard to him. We had been laid off, as few of us at the Grand Lab at that time. He felt his job was taken away from him. I remember that conversation we had at the Lone Star, our last conversation. He felt he lost the reason and motivation to wake up every morning, what kept his life moving and the fuel of his soul. Our last conversation at the Lone Star, we talked about the future, and he said, "I am moving out of San Francisco. This is not a nice city to people our age. I will finish my thesis in Durango and get my PhD. No way I will be living in San Francisco from welfare." I remember those words at that time, and those were very tough. I remember being a foreigner in that city. That was scary. Next slide, please. He did not have time to do either his thesis or move out of San Francisco. He was in a rush looking for peace. In the end, I think that Jeff found a way to leave this world with dignity. Next slide, please. So wherever you are now, my friend, I hope you found the peace you were looking for. And when we reunite, I guess, wherever it is, the first round of love, I let I see part of me. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pedro, for that really moving and personal recollection of Jeff. That was really beautiful. Thank you very much for sharing that with us this morning. So we're going to move on, and I'd like to introduce Bob Grant, who is a senior investigator at the University of California, San Francisco. He was the lead on the IPREX trial with the Gladstone Institutes. He's also medical director at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. Bob, are you ready? Bob, if you're with us, you need to press star 7 to unmute your line.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yes, Bob. That's great.
Great. Well, thank you, Jim and Julie, for setting this up. I think that Jeff's work needs to be remembered, and it was so unique and powerful in so many ways. Jeff worked with me at Gladstone for 12 years as a project manager, study coordinator, resident sociologist, and iconoclast. I think if I'm going to say anything this morning, it's that the best science comes from activism, and the best activism is rooted in science. And Jeff was both. Jeff worked on all of our most important projects, drug resistance transmission, identification of transmission clusters, serosorting and seroadaptation, superinfection, and pre-exposure prophylaxis. All of this research was successful, interesting, and important, and widely appreciated. One theme that tied Jeff's work together was his insight that much of human behavior has social goals, social determinants, and social consequences. While others sought to explain what we do in terms of internal dynamics, desires, greed, selfishness, or mental illness. Jeff recognized that our desire to share our lives, to love, and to be loved, drives our behavior. This theme of our connectedness was also the foundation of his personal and professional career. To be true, he was a true believer in sociology and invoked society not merely as a context for human behavior, but rather as the root of what we do, his belief in sociology also showed in his treatment of others in the laboratory. He was often kind, and particularly kind when people needed kindness. He was sometimes fierce, you know, especially when people needed ferocity. I guess I frequently needed ferocity because he was always commenting on what I said. He was among us. Today, I want to speak more personally about some of the major moments that were quintessentially Jeff McConnell. These moments inspire the next generation of my work. It was a cold and snowy night in Boston in February 2003, 11 years ago. I was sitting with Jeff in his hotel room. He was making last-minute revisions for his talk to be given at the 2003 CROWE conference. May I have the next slide, please? He had, when he submitted the abstract titled entitled Sorting Out Surasorting with Sexual Network Methods, I thought it might be accepted as a poster and was pleasantly surprised when he was offered a talk. When I saw his draft presentation in that hotel room, though, I was surprised, maybe even shocked, that Jeff was claiming that the incidence of new HIV infections was decreasing in San Francisco. This was not the conventional wisdom, as people widely believed that HIV infection rates were increasing in San Francisco. Why? Because syphilis rates were increasing and condom use was on the wane, and there was widespread concern that the gay community was returning to the heydays of the 1970s before the AIDS epidemic hit. The conventional wisdom was that life-saving therapy, introduced a few years earlier, had let the sexual genie back out of the bottle. Yet Jeff had reviewed all of the available data and found that directly measured HIV rates were decreasing in one San Francisco-based cohort, and HIV prevalence in testing programs was also decreasing. Still, in my mind, Jeff's claim that HIV was waning while the conventional wisdom was the opposite was bold. I suggested to Jeff that he could make his points about serosorting and superinfection risk without being quite so iconoclastic. After all, it would be enough to explain his data indicating that people were preferring partners having the same HIV status. Such serosorting or seroadaptive behavior was a strong pattern in his positive partner study. But Jeff would have nothing of it. He was not happy with a more technically focused and safe approach that I advocated. If there was an opportunity to disrupt conventional wisdom with theory and data, Jeff would be sure to act. The next day, introduced as Dr. McConnell, Jeff stepped up to the podium in front of about 600 scientists, his flowing red hair framing the podium. The room was hushed as he explained that HIV rates and syphilis rates had become disconnected because of serosorting. Positive people selecting other positive partners based on HIV status, but not syphilis status. People were surprised and said so, even objected. One person asked how he could claim that HIV incidence was declining in San Francisco when the Department of Public Health had concluded the opposite just months before. He responded that the data was what it was. I recall that afterward there was plenty of dismay, but a few came up and said, bravo, and highlighted how they had heard of serosorting, but had no idea how to study the phenomena or even their own data until they heard Jeff's presentation. Importantly, over the following 4 years, from 2003 to 2007, there were multiple publications on serosorting from San Francisco, Amsterdam, Seattle, Uganda, all showing the same thing Jeff had described in his data from San Francisco. there's a strong preference for partnerships between positive partners, accounting for changes in condom use and the growing disconnect between HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. Furthermore, the conventional wisdom in San Francisco had changed. As people concluded that HIV incidence really was decreasing, as Jeff had noted, San Francisco became a poster child for successful epidemic control. Once thought to be a sentinel for loss of epidemic control, San Francisco became the lead example for success, partly because Jeff explained why human behavior, the search for connection, had made the situation much more complex than our science. The science improved. Next slide. Jeff advocated an approach to sexual history taking that focused on partnerships rather than the numbers of sex acts or the numbers of partners. Let me give you an example. Typically, clinical research on HIV will ask people about numbers of partners in the last 3 to 6 months and how many times a specific sex act had occurred with all of those partners. As Jeff's work on seroadaptive behavior became accepted, people started asking about the serostatus of sexual partners. How many were positive? How many were negative? How many had unknown serostatus? Yet the social interaction was still lost in most of our questionnaires. Who is this partner? Where did you meet him? Do you want to see him again? Was there intimacy? What about pleasure and love? Jeff received an opportunity to evaluate his alternative approach in the IPREC study. Jeff asked about partnerships. The questions start with thinking of names, pseudonyms if you like, for the last 3 or 4 sex partners. Let us say Frank or Harry. Then he would ask about how Harry came into the respondent's life, whether the sex was fun, intimate, pleasurable, and did he want to see Harry again. Interestingly, a large portion of people who had denied condomless receptive anal intercourse in the standard questions were happy to report this very same activity with Harry. Indeed, framing the question in a sexual network brought these acts back to life and forward in everyone's memory. Importantly, while questionnaires about abstract sexual risk behavior were dreaded and always regarded to be too long, people enjoyed answering Jeff's questions about their partners. For his positive partner studies on superinfection, he asked about all the sexual partners in the past year, and for many of our participants, this conversation went over more than an hour, and yet people enjoyed talking about the people they love. I believe that Jeff left his best work unfinished. I have notes from his manuscript that he was writing with his dear friend John Gagnon. They titled it Making Community, Sex and the Emergence of a Gay Minority. I'd like to read a few excerpts from that unpublished manuscript. Jeff writes, the role of specific sex practices has been at the center of the discussion of the transmission of HIV and its prevention since the beginnings of the epidemic. A concern with sex as vector or sex as risk retains its centrality in the scientific and popular literature in the study of HIV prevention. The history of sexuality, even in the near past, remains largely opaque. While we are persuaded that sex is one of the more powerful forces in human life, its story is composed of assumption and anecdotes and scandal. Jeff writes further, sexual exchange, literally sexual intercourse, appears in San Francisco's history to have been at least as much a driving force in gay community building as it was a response to the gay liberation rhetoric, perhaps even more so. Reflecting upon gay sex in the 1970s, Roger McFarlane surmises, as Jeff quotes, it may have seemed trivial, but it's where we learned to love ourselves, to love each other, and it's what made possible our heroic reaction when the war came, referring to the appearance of HIV in the 1980s. Sex, and then Jeff goes on to write, sex in the last half of the 1960s and through the 1970s did not represent gay men in a state of nature, unfettered by social regulation of their sexuality. He reflected gay men in a process of constructing identities, relationships, neighborhoods, and communities within which their sexuality could be socially organized, productive, and politically effective as never before. So John Gagnon has indicated that he is committed to submitting their work for publication. We hope to do that in the next year. So just wanted to end by, next slide. Just wanted to end by describing my favorite memory among so many with Jeff. We were walking home early in the morning in Lima after a night in the bars. It was 2005, and proper search was extremely controversial, with trial failures in Cambodia, West Africa, and Malawi, and a growing crowd of people wishing to see our IPREX trial fail as well. Yet that night, with Jeff, I felt safe and comfortable, at home exploring novelty, and assured that our work would somehow work out, because we liked each other. We were, in a web of love that Jeff fostered, the kind of love that builds courage so that we may see what we are afraid of seeing and do what we are afraid of doing. Such courage underlies our best science and our best activism, and Jeff was both a scientist and an activist. Thank you for letting me talk here. Those are the end of my comments.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. And while we're flipping through these beautiful pictures, we will take a short pause to see if there are any questions for clarification. You can leave those questions in the chat. Or if you would like to ask a question for clarification verbally, you can press *7 to unmute your phone. So it looks like we have a couple of questions here. So I'm going to, I think this is probably for Bob, but Bob or Pedro, you can both feel free to respond. This is from Anna Forbes, and she says this is exactly the kind of complexity we need to recognize with regard to women and adherence and prevention trials. As Jeff showed us, we can't understand how risk works unless we ask people how they see their sex lives and what factors influence the sexual decisions. What can we do to get increased investment in this sensitive social science research, like what Judy Auerbeck is doing, to help us understand this? Do you have thoughts on that, Bob?
I think that, it's really a question for everyone on the line. I mean, what can we do to bring social science perspectives into our clinical trials and our work? I think that it's very important that we distinguish social science from behavioral science. And frankly, I think there is some confusion on this. Let's acknowledge that social psychology does seek to understand people's behavior in a social context, but typically there isn't a direct focus on what that social context is. It's analyzed as contextual variables, confounders, if you will, but not the focus of the research itself. So, I think that encouraging our funding agencies to create study sections comprised of sociologists and anthropologists would be a good first step. It simply is not going to be possible or fundable to propose social science projects that were reviewed by psychologists. and that is the usual practice at this time. So, you know, I think building a infrastructure for genuine social science is key. Again, I think that this work, Jeff's work, really was born of activism. So people had to stand up and demand this. They had to demand that their social environment be understood for its own sake and not as some sort of confounding variable.
Thanks very much for those comments, Bob. I would just like to chime in, and maybe we can talk about this later in the discussion period, but, you know, it has occurred to me and many of us that we have advocates for treatment, we have advocates for various prevention technologies like microbicides or PrEP or vaccines. We really could use some concerted advocacy around the social sciences and the behavioral sciences, and to really, as Bob so beautifully says, we need to demand it, ask for it, say it's important. I think our colleagues doing this work really need the backup of some advocacy and some community engagement on these specifically. And I don't really think that exists yet, and I hope maybe this call can inspire us to just be more thoughtful about and being specific about that kind of advocacy work. We're going to take one more quick question, and then we're going to move to our next speaker. But I will, any questions that are coming up in the queue, we'll keep track of. One more thing for you, Bob. Just a follow-up question or a clarifying question. Wanted to know how you were able to get such reliable data about sexual behavior.
Well, you know, I in many cases we are relying on people's self-report, and so you know, I think that the we believe that our information is more reliable because people were in a situation where they enjoyed sharing it, you know, and that was the goal. One of the goals of focusing on sexual networks is really to create an environment where people enjoy sharing information. And in that context, I think people are less reserved, more inclined to disclose what's happening. I think that, we do rely on self-report of sexual behavior, and I think, we need the sociology to understand under what circumstances like self-report can be relied upon and when it's highly biased to the point where, it's confusing.
Thanks, Bob. And keep those questions percolating. We will open it up to a fuller, broader discussion when we're done with our panelists. I'd like to now ask Gus from...
Hello?
Yes, hi, Gus, from NAM Publications, AIDS Map. Mm-hmm. He's an incredible writer, editor, activist, advocate, and someone who I really rely on to help me make sense of everything HIV prevention. You have a huge task on your hands, Gus, to help me make sense of everything. So Gus is going to actually be presenting on a couple of studies, some updated science, both on the PROUD study and the partner results. So take it away, Gus.
Hello, everybody. I mean, firstly, I think I'd like to say how honored I am to be asked to do this, especially as I'm not someone who actually knew Jeff personally. I mean, I'm stuck across the other side of the Atlantic in London, and I think I've only saw Jeff as a presenter at a couple of conferences. I was looking up sort of reports we'd done on serous sorting studies he'd done in San Francisco and stuff. And so I'm tremendously honored that you guys should think of me as being the person who essentially is kind of, I'm going to try and describe, I think, where we are at in prevention right now. I've just been writing a huge summary of where we are in PrEP science for UNAIDS, and it's at a tremendously pivotal stage at the moment with prevention options trembling on the brink of being realized, as it were. But I also wanted to comment on the last question. I think sex really finding out about sex isn't about finding out about figures. It's about finding out about stories. You'll never capture sex in a quantitative study. You'll capture what people kind of think about sex. But if you really want to go to the heart of sort of attraction and surrender and risk taking and all that sort of need, all that sort of thing, you have to go to the qualitative studies. And certainly recently I've learned so much from some of the qualitative studies that are embedded into things like the PrEP studies, things like the interviews with the FemPrep and voice participants and what they really, really felt about kind of this trial they were being asked to be engaged in. We've done a lot of qualitative work with the guys in the Proud study as well, and learning how they really fit PrEP into their lives and why they decided to take it. So it's the stories people tell us we really need to hear about. Having said that, I'm the sort of quantitative guy. I share with Jeff a conviction that, you know, if you can get the data precise, at least if you can't get people to believe you, at least you have the evidence. So we've made tremendous... next slide, please. This is a sort of little picture of kind of the difference that sort of 10 years of prevention research has made in terms of kind of what we know about the efficacy of various HIV prevention methods. I'm not going to go through it in huge detail, but it tells us a couple of things. Firstly, how incredibly effective treatment as prevention is and ARV-based prevention is in general. But also how varied it is, how utterly dependent it is on the degree to which people invest in the prevention method as offered to them. The red bars on the right are the results from the PrEP studies, and you don't need me to tell you that the results we've got from the PrEP studies range from PrEP doesn't work to PrEP works nearly all the time. And so as if that wasn't, you know, as if we didn't need to be reminded, this reminds us that it's offering people something that fits into their daily lives and fits into their sex lives and enables them to have, to use the formula that Sigma use over here, the best sex with the least harm, that really is what we need. So I'm going to sort of skip to the conclusions, as it were, but I will reprise this at the end. Next slide, please. I think the sort of absolutely key lessons we've learned in the last few years in terms of any prevention measure, and this includes things we already use such as condoms, adherence is all. You've got, you know, it doesn't work if you don't stick to it. Until we get that 100% kind of neutralizing vaccine, then this is going to be the case. Community investment is essential. We've learned this from the PrEP trials, that it was, I think IPREX was the first one to come out with a positive result precisely because of the vast amount of work that they put in before anyone ever took a pill. The sheer amount of research they did into the MSM and TG community in Peru and Ecuador, learning things they'd never learned before about men who have sex with men, and making sure that they had a huge investment in this trial. I think that's so important. Prevention methods must fit lifestyles. If we're going to talk about PrEP, I think we're already standing out. People are not going to use it like treatment. They are going to use it as a sort of as a way of moderating their risk, but they're not. They don't. You know, it's not something that they're going to depend on for their lives. And so, we need to factor in a prevention, a way of using PrEP, which enables people to use it safely, even though their adherence may be lower. But one other thing we've learned is that people do generally, not always, have a fairly good idea of when they've been at risk, and people will often adjust their usage to it. And that there are groups that have great difficulty in adhering both to treatment and to any other biomedical prevention method and in some ways to condoms, and being young is a big risk factor in terms of finding it difficult to adhere to these things. So is gender for very different reasons, power imbalances, lack of opportunity, the complexities of leading a woman's life. But so many other things also affect it. Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. This is just a little bit of a reminder. I'm going to do treatment as prevention first. This is a little bit of a reminder of the pivotal study, HPTN052. I remember when the results came through from this, how I wasn't surprised. I'd sort of had a sense that antiretrovirals, or knew that antiretrovirals very likely had a huge impact on whether people were infectious or not. For years, I knew the people who wrote the Swiss statement. Even before then, I'd almost taken it for granted that it was the case. But even amongst people for whom something is biologically plausible, when a study comes out and says this is the case, the impact that that had on prevention was enormous, and I think it's going to be even bigger in the next few years. Certainly, WHO and UNAIDS is moving towards a policy of having universal treatment on diagnosis, and I think the whole way we do prevention in the future is going to change completely worldwide. I've bolded the bit at the bottom, the 11 unlinked transmissions, 28%, and this was in a pretty kind of what you might call a fairly monogamous heterosexual milieu. Just as a reminder that just getting certain people on treatment is not going to be enough. We need to get enough people on treatment and on PrEP to actually cut the chain of transmission. But what HPTN052 basically tells us is that if you give people antiretrovirals, it pretty much, as far as we can see, abolishes the risk of them transmitting. And I'm happy to say that. Next slide. Okay, so this was the news at CROI this February, March, I think the researchers themselves were surprised how much attention was given to this announcement. I mean, the partner study is not a randomized control study. It's a longitudinal cohort study. All it's doing is basically looking at whether people who are the negative partner in zero different couples get HIV from their partners who are on treatment. And the answer is that so far they haven't, not a single one of them. It was extraordinary, really, the reaction that this caused in the gay community and in the blogosphere, ranging from people saying, I simply don't believe it, to people feeling that it was some kind of vindication. It was no surprise to me at all. And yet, I think there's been so much fear among gay men and so much skepticism that treatment really could act with this degree of efficacy. You know, people needed reassurance. And really, I mean, this pretty much says if you give somebody treatment, you are making them enormously less infectious, including via anal sex. Okay. Having said this, the results have a couple of important exclusions. Again, we don't have figures for infections that came from outside the central relationship, the central couple. And it also excludes instances where the negative partner had treatment failure, although that's only 5% of the total. Nonetheless, those are a couple of really important caveats in terms of our overall prevention strategy. Next slide, please. Okay, so now this is the nerdy slide, but I only include this because I've been asked all these questions. What they were able to say from the figures that they had in the partner study so far is, and go to the second bullet point, that the risk, they were able to say that the risk from all sex was ranged from 0 to 0.5% annual risk of transmission, for anal sex 0 to 1% and various other increased risks. And people were getting pretty obsessive about what these confidence intervals mean. And confidence intervals are hard to explain. Bob will probably correct me on this. I feel a little nervous about explaining this in front of him. basically. They do not give the data. They give the fuzziness of the data. Not, as I say, to use the metaphor I've used before, there is a bird in this big picture, but the chance that this particular pixel is a bird and not a stray pixel is X percent. What that means is that as we get more data, then the confidence interval will narrow. And what will be really fascinating in the partner study is whether that narrowing converges on a point, 0.1% or something like that, or whether it converges on zero, and we don't know that. At the moment, all we can say is that the maximum likely chance of these various kinds of sex are the percentages stated. So we do need more data. Partner is going to recruit a bunch more gay men, and its final results won't be out for 3 years. Next slide. So here's a little favourite cartoon of mine. And as I say, the sort of glass full vision of this is that the real chance of transmission is probably zero or just about zero, and the confidence interval will edge closer to that with more data. I've got a correction here from Alison Roger. The 1.7 years, which she's just sent to me on an email, the 1.7 years is median follow-up per couple, not overall. The overall follow-up is 894 couple years, of which about 300 are in gay men. So that's roughly, 35%. Okay. But of course the glass empty view is that nonetheless, even at this very small chance of transmission, if you take a relationship that takes 10 years, then there is certainly, and perhaps still, we don't know yet, a chance of transmission. We have no idea. Probably more to do with treatment failure. But even this is at least 20 times better. Even the maximum likelihood is at least 20 times better than the chance of that transmission from an untreated partner. Next slide. And so this is, I mean, obviously we know that treatment is prevention, and Jeff McConnell knew this years ago, that in areas with good treatment access, like the UK and San Francisco, but not necessarily some other parts of the US, most transmissions are now from the undiagnosed and nearly all from the untreated. This is the presentation from Valerie Delpech at the last IOPAC TASP Summit. So the number of transmissions from people who are on HIV and who are on treatment is something like 5% of the total. And so I really do think this sort of, this begs the question of whether there should be kind of pretty much universal treatment on diagnosis or not. Next slide. One of the things we've done as a community is we sensed that there was tremendous kind of confusion, disagreement about exactly the line to take about treatment as prevention, and a concern, I think, that we needed to sort of keep hold of the agenda on this. And so one of the things that NAM and EATG did last year was to write this community consensus statement on the use of antiretroviral therapy. It's a sign-on document. And I'd like to invite you to visit that website there at the top and take a look at the statement. It's not a guideline. It's not a policy document. What it is a set of basic principles which we hope people devising treatments as prevention programs in all sorts of areas of the world will take into account, so they don't either enact crude sort of public health measures which will go against people's own interests or are too careful about advancing something with huge potential. Next slide, please. Okay, so Bob has already shown us a nice little picture of clusters, infection clusters. This wonderful snowflake diagram is from the CROI this year and is a picture of the sort of infection clusters amongst gay men in New York. Isn't it pretty? But what it means is that in certain, and again, this is a hypothesis, it's not necessarily anything that's been worked out to the nth degree, that in some highly connected epidemics where people have lots of partners, are having high-risk sex, maybe quite a few people in acute infection, test and treat may not be enough. And that's maybe why we need PrEP, or, you know, other things, but PrEP is the thing we're kind of mainly trying out at the moment. And certainly, Brian Williams, the, I think, rather brilliant modeler from South Africa, has worked out that PrEP in pretty much anywhere will be cost-effective, where HIV incidence is more than 6% a year. And, of course, we know it is in certain highly concentrated groups of gay men. It's much, much more than that. The highest, apart from a few studies amongst the injecting drug users, the highest incidences we've seen anywhere. And I can tell you that, although this isn't published data, that the incidence, the background incidence, this is the baseline incidence in the PROUD study, is certainly at least as big as that. Next slide. Okay, so I'm going to just run through a few, not just one, a few PrEP studies. And the PROUD is the one I'm involved in, and again, I'm very honoured. I was very honoured to be asked by Sheena McCormack, who's a veteran prevention researcher, to be co-chair of the steering committee for this one. And this is an open-label study in the UK. Because we have a sort of unique network of specific sexual health clinics, we felt we were in a particularly good position to do this one. And what we're doing is we're offering open-label PrEP, but what we're doing is offering half the guys PrEP immediately and half delayed by a year. Now, in the States, you couldn't do this because PrEP's already licensed, and people say, hang on, we want it. But, of course, in Europe, we're probably years behind you on PrEP. But there's been a huge, because we have very different health systems. And so half of them are getting PrEP after the first year. We've fully recruited now. We've got to our 550. And we've already done quite a bit of sort of demographic research. We found that these guys had quite a high number of partners, but were condom using too. This isn't the sort of no, never ever use condoms group. This is more a group of guys who are selectively using condoms, and came along because they were interested in protecting themselves. They had a very high rate of PEP usage pre-PROUD. 40% in a year had used PEP, in the previous year had used PrEP, and 21% more than once. And of course, this has some effect on the cost effectiveness of PrEP. Very high levels of drug use, very high levels of STIs, as I say, the baseline incidence is going to be high. We also have informal news, and I don't know how it's sorted out into arms because I'm not allowed to know. But the actual incidence observed in the study of HIV has been high. High enough so that if it was concentrated into the control arm or the intervention arm, we might have an efficacy result, but I cannot say that. There's been quite a lot of hepatitis C cases diagnosed as well, which also kind of gives you an idea of these guys' risk profile. We've had quite a few participant involvement meetings, and the whole study was actually got together from a number of kind of community discussions where we thrashed out the protocol and who should be involved, and there's a community liaison group and so on. And the interviews we've had so far is that the participants are pretty happy with the daily PrEP regimen they're getting. They don't really think that alternatives would work any better. They like the dailiness of it. It's a good reminder. That's interesting in terms of kind of talking about other PrEP designs. Bob's just asked a question, so I'll answer that right now. The biggest concern, and I think it's not so much adherence these days, people are getting the message that in open-label studies adherence is improved. But what I get from PrEP skeptics is risk compensation. They'll all stop using condoms, and even if PrEP is incredibly effective, that means they'll get loads of STIs. And I think the biggest challenge for selling PrEP in the future will be that this is a prevention method that improves reduces guys' HIV risk, but which may lay them open to a lower general standard of sexual health. And I think that's a question that needs to be discussed, frankly, honestly, and put into an overall sexual health strategy. And the next slide. Just a few more things. Some of this you might know about more than me. This is the US demo project. Really interesting. Three different cities, three very different groups of gay men. Look at the difference in adherence here. 92% in San Francisco, 53% in Miami. This is not self-report. This is from drug levels. One of the reasons is that you have a younger and much more non-white group in Miami, a lot of young Latinos that are more uninsured, even though they have lower risky sex and drug use. So far, not a lot of Afro-Americans. I hope that will improve as the D.C. recruitment. They were the last, I think the last city to come online, improves. 69% had heard of PrEP. That's really interesting because only a couple of years ago, 3 years ago, only 22% had heard of it. So that's been really interesting. Okay, next slide, please. This was an interesting one, and shows that, yes, it is possible, to do a PrEP study amongst MSM in Africa. In other words, we didn't stop with voice and FemPrep and Partners Prep and TDF2. This is ongoing and is now focusing on studies that really look about how people could use PrEP in that kind of context. This is largely MSM with a few female sex workers. Short study, it's an acceptability study, not an efficacy study, and they used what they call a coitally dependent regimen. In other words, you only take PrEP before you think you're going to have sex and you take another dose afterwards. And they compared it with daily dosing. Daily dosing, not a problem, high adherence. Intermittent dosing, again, the same message as what people were saying informally in the PROUD study. Found it very difficult. Found it difficult to take a dose after sex, as one guy said. We tend to fall asleep after sex. Also, sex involves often having a drink with people. They traveled around a lot, these guys. We're talking about an informal network of MSM, some of whom kind of have commercial sex, some of whom don't. They'd often be in and out of each other's houses. And the other thing, and this, funnily enough, actually came up in PROUD, so it's not just an African concern. They wanted a clearly different size and shape of pill. In other words, it might be the same drug, but they wanted one that says, this is the PrEP pill they're taking. And there's been there was one case in E001 where a guy actually, just for the sake of quietness, eventually said, yes, I am positive, rather than actually say I'm on the PrEP trial, because it was simpler to say it. And there was an incident that happened to one of the users in the PROUD trial where a positive friend of his came out as HIV positive to him because he assumed that the other guy was also positive because he saw he was taking Truvada. And the other guy didn't have the heart or was too embarrassed to say, actually, no, I'm on a PrEP trial. So that may be an issue in future. Next slide. Okay. FemPrep. Now, this is what I'm talking about when I talk about the value of qualitative studies. We know that FemPrep was one of the trials that did not produce a positive result, that the participants claimed very high levels of adherence, but the drug levels told a very different story, less than 26% adherence. And so there's been several, actually, qualitative studies. And these are really the reasons that people were talking about. And some of them, I think, were to do with this being a placebo-controlled trial. I think Bob has said that he expected adherence to be higher if people know they're taking PrEP. And to some extent, this bears this out. And the one in red is the most commonly cited reason. Obviously, they could cite more than one reason. But these women knew that they were taking something that might possibly offer them no benefit at all. And if you add together that with the perception you might be on the placebo, you get a very high percentage. But also some other important things. But also, this doesn't quite capture a comment that was in the poster at Croy, which was that there was a general kind of atmosphere of talk and discussion amongst the participants, and in this particular case, rather than it kind of being a reinforcement and encouragement to take PrEP, there was a kind of a community reaction to the trial where participants would talk to each other and they say, are you taking it? And say, nah, not really. Are you? Nah, I don't see the point. And this kind of snowballed. And that's kind of what happened in FemPrep. It was really, really interesting. And there's just literally in the last 3 days, I think, a similar study come out from Voice with very similar conclusions. So the sort of community backing and the community understanding of PrEP and, of course, of treatment as prevention programs is key. So, next slide. And it's what I promised. It's the sort of back to the conclusions. Community investment is absolutely essential in the design, in the rollout of PrEP and treatment and other prevention studies. People have to feel this is for them. They own it. They know, they want to be knowledgeable about it. Their opinion is valued. Their lifestyles are understood. You know, and if you offer them something that isn't compatible with their lifestyle, they won't take it. So I think those are really the lessons that we've come from them. And I'm really interested in the next generation of prevention studies and what's going to come out in the next few years, because there's a whole bunch of PrEP studies out there at the moment, and they're all going to learn lots of little things. I think there's about 22 randomized studies out there at the moment amongst all sorts of people in all sorts of countries, and we're going to learn a lot about this intervention. Okay, so that's my bit. There's a thank you slide. So I'd like to thank these guys in particular for advising me, and Bob's up there because of his explanations from many things in the past. Mark Hubbard I'd like to highlight because he managed to sort out my understanding of the confidence intervals in partner. And so many thanks to you guys.
And many thanks to you, Gus, for a really wonderful presentation. And as you said, much...
Thank you, Trevor. Anyway, yeah, go on.
We're loving on each other. So thank you so much for all of that. That was fantastic. We do have one more speaker. Suraj is going to give us a quick update on, and some of you may know this already or may not know, but there's been some interesting changes at CDC in terms of language use. So we're going to discuss that. But I do want to take a few moments to see if there are clarifying questions for Gus. He did just share a lot of data. We did get one question in that I don't think you can answer, Gus, but maybe between us on the call we can. Someone asking, have there been any PrEP studies done in Texas, specifically Dallas?
And can't remember offhand. What I will do is call up this thing I've just written, which has a list of everything I was able to compile, partially from the AVAC list, of the current studies. I don't recall Texas specifically being the subject of a randomized study, but that doesn't mean to say there isn't some kind of rollout there.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that either. I am aware, though, that the CDC is planning 4 implementation studies in the United States. So these are different than demo projects in that people are not provided the drug. They join the study, they get the drug in whatever way they would normally get it in, quote, the real world, and then they're followed. So it's another step towards reality. Demo projects, people are provided the drug. And it's my understanding that there may be a site in Texas. They're looking at 4. I know there's going to be one in Chicago. And I know that some of the details are still being hammered out, so it can't be more specific about Texas right now. There is another question for you, Gus. What is your quick answer to PrEP skeptics about behavioral disinhibition?
Right. Okay. I'm very respectful of the position that what we really need to be doing is improving gay men's sexual health in general. And certainly I'm kind of troubled by some of the levels of STIs amongst the positive population who've been serosorting. However, HIV, I mean, pardon my language, but HIV is a motherfucker. I have it. I've spent my whole life pretending to myself, or indeed, you know, in some ways saying to myself, it's no great big deal, we all know you can manage it, etc., etc. But there is nothing else that combines 100% lethality of untreated with lifelong infection. There's nothing else like it. And so I think if we can prevent it in itself, that will be a good thing. The other point I would say is this. One of the things you're doing with PrEP, that may be less the case as time goes on, but certainly at the moment, is that you're bringing in high-risk negative guys into the health system. They're getting HIV checkups. They're getting STI checkups. This may be a way of catching negative guys earlier, at a point that they're starting to think seriously about their risk and wanting to do something about it. And that may have an impact in itself.
Thank you very much, Gus. And thank you all for the questions. We're going to go to our last speaker so we can scrape some time together at the end for more Q&A for all of our speakers. I'd like to bring to the mic, Suraj Madhuri with the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance, who's going to talk about the evolution of our language of prevention. Go ahead, Suraj.
Hi, everyone. This is Suraj Madhuri. Just a quick thank you to AVAC for the tremendous webinar assistance and to the panelists before me for just their remarkable work overall. And what I'm going to sort of bookend with Gus, having gone through the science, now where are we going with the advocacy? So what I really want to point out to everyone is how we are really changing the language of prevention, how we did that just this past year, and how to build that moving forward. So next slide, please. So for people who don't know, the CDC had released a November 2015 Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, MMWR. It was titled The Sexual Risk Lower Among U.S. Gay and Bisexual Men Who Actually Know Their HIV Status. And I'm happy to share a link to this after the presentation. But one of the things that a whole bunch of advocates noticed was that, you know, the use of the language was really stigmatizing and blaming. And there was this very specific focus on rising rates of men reporting sex without condoms. But the thing was that the language that was used was unprotected sex, which was used in place of condomless sex or sex without condoms. And there was this real risk that there was this conflation of unprotected to solely mean sex without condoms, but it wasn't very clear. But what it also doesn't allow, it doesn't allow the acknowledgement of the other ways that communities protect themselves. So we're talking about, you know, obviously the strategies that we've been talking about, PrEP, PEP, seroadaptation, serosorting. And there was this real need for the CDC to be more up-to-date in reflecting the accurate reality of the HIV prevention landscape. Next slide, please. So in response, there was an open letter that was created by Advocates and Allies, and about 50 organizations signed on, and one of them made a very clear set of demands, and among them was a demand on the clarity of terms and really kind of getting at the issue of unprotected sex, meaning only condomless sex, and also how that really doesn't give justice to the number of HIV prevention strategies that are out there and aren't out there, and also sending confusing messages to the community and how they can really protect themselves. And there was some media coverage in HIV/AIDS and gay press, which also kind of went alongside with our advocacy. Next slide, please. So the process and the response was actually pretty quick. We submitted a letter to the CDC, and we had a really immediate request for a phone meeting. So after sharing various points raised by the letter, the CDC acknowledged our concerns, and they also definitively agreed to take action on bringing about the language change. So later, a number of us actually met with CDC at CROI in Boston this year, and to really kind of allow the CDC to give us the full breadth of their plans and limitations in what they need to do to actually implement the language change across the board. So they assured us that the changes that there would be changes to the CDC website, and that would occur almost immediately. But there were limitations. Limitations would include, you know, doing an actual mandate across the agency, and they would not retroactively change language, as in they would not go into past publications or past manuals and things like that and change the language. And then publications that were already in the pipeline or any materials will not be pulled to actually include the language change. So it was interesting because, like, they responded fairly quickly, and it was really a great victory on our part. And I also want to take a moment to acknowledge really two things. This victory really showed the power of the HIV PGA Network and its ability to reflect and really respond to the needs of our members. And I think it's just showed that it's an amazing force in shaping public policy. Also, you know, this was really a victory for public health itself. I think, you know, just hearing the past presenters on this webinar, Jeff McConnell really showed us that HIV prevention is not one-dimensional, and that with the very same idea, we conveyed that, to the CDC, that HIV prevention really truly is not one-dimensional, and it's the agency's benefit to reflect the evolving world of HIV prevention, and to really reflect important information about prevention that is both accurate and timely. So that, you know, that communities at risk have the best possible information to make choices about the way they protect themselves. So really, we claimed a victory over this. So really, it was a really great victory overall for public health, and to the many communities that have been using proven methods of protecting themselves against HIV, and having the CDC actually accurately and acknowledge how important these other ways of HIV prevention strategies are. And I think, again, it kind of goes back to showing that Jeff McConnell has always said, and from what I've read with a lot of what he's published in thebody.com and a couple other places, that he really pushes the fact that HIV prevention is not a one-dimensional, one-size-fits-all, and it requires a depth of strategies for people and for communities to protect themselves. So it was really great that the CDC was able to really take the lead and really address our concerns to change the language. And it also leaves us with a number of ways that we still can continue to build upon the success. And, you know, as we continue to build the notion that HIV prevention is multidimensional, there's still a ton of work left to do to continue the momentum of this victory and to really build upon the legacy of Jeff. So one of the ways that we could really do that is to really kind of build more wider systems advocacy. And we're talking beyond CDC. We are also hoping that we can start interacting with SAMHSA and DHS and Department of Education to really kind of help them as well reflect this needed language change on HIV prevention. And then we also need to really kind of continue to engage and figure out the depth of our relationship with CDC and how can we continue to interact with them and also holding them accountable to the remaining issues that are stemming from a letter. And I'll actually go into that at the bottom right there of this slide. So, but the third point actually is really interesting because this was actually something that was pointed out by our network members. And what they found is that, like, a lot of organizations that have signed onto the letter, that many of them in their own communications had the same language used by the CDC prior to the letter. So they were also using unprotected sex to mean condomless sex. And so what this also kind of points to is that there's a real need to get guidance from the CDC and for the CDC to be a leader in ensuring that all CBOs and ASOs, both funded and not funded by the CDC, get a clear mandate or guidance in changing their materials and practices to reflect a new era of HIV prevention. So it's very important that, and it's very important for CDC to really recognize that there needs to be guidance from them, being such a leader in HIV prevention, to help other organizations update their materials and also issue best practices and how we can really communicate clearly and effectively about new prevention strategies and also support systems that do. So the remaining issues from the letters that we're still hoping to contend with and aim on continuing to discuss with the CDC include changing the testing frequency from once annually to one that goes in line with prevention strategies like PrEP. So we're talking, you know, with PrEP that there needs to be at least 3 months of testing throughout the year for PrEP to be basically be monitored well and to ensure that, you know, adherence is going well and to make sure that we're controlling transmission and infection. So as said before, the HIV prevention is multidimensional. So part of that, part of what we're asking cities to support a system that allows for new prevention strategies to flourish, so that it includes changing the testing guidelines to once every 3 months, once every 4 months, to obviously support prevention strategies like PrEP, and to keep it, to really support it to succeed, I should say. So we also really both praise CDC for having taken steps in improving the collection of data on transgender people, but we still caution them to be very clear about whether data does or does not reflect their inclusion in the NHBS survey. And some of the examples that we gave was, like, you know, sort of giving an explicit disclaimer on how or if transgender people are included in the data or how are they being defined. And this is really so that, you know, policymakers and the press can really kind of make better decisions on how to utilize and interpret the data and how it's being reflective of all transgender populations. And that's my final slide. I know we don't have much time left, so I want to allow some time for Q&A.
Thank you very much, Siraj, and thanks again to our presenters and to all of you for hanging in there. We are running short on time, so I am going to ask each of the presenters to give us one marching order, one thing that we all should take, it would be great to take from this call to move ourselves forward. And I'm going to take the moderator's perspective here, or prerogative, I should say, and say that while I totally agree with Siraj and HIV-PGA that we need leadership from CDC on language change and how to better communicate prevention, better communicate risk, better communicate protection, I don't think we should wait for them. Mm-hmm. I think we should absolutely do this ourselves, our communities. We should be grappling this within our organizations right now. We have often led the way. Jeff led the way. Our communities lead the way. Gus talked about communities really owning it. We've actually really heard the community spread throughout. It's the most powerful force, and I think we can really take ownership of how we talk about these things and start to make those changes ourselves. We don't need to wait for a governmental institution. Not to let them abdicate from the need to do that, but that would be my take. And now I would like to go down the list as we're heading into our last 5 minutes. Pedro, do you have one marching order for our webinar participants today as we move forward?
What I learned from Jeff, and I learned a lot from him, it's just that as scientists, we should look at sexuality with less taboos and from a more natural perspective. That's us. And I remember discussing with him, it was the thing is that with scientists, if they are trying to count frequencies and standardize sexual behavior, and actually sexual behavior is personal. So that's what I take from it, and our approach to understanding it should be broader.
Thank you, Pedro. Beautiful. Bob, what's our marching order from you today?
Well, I would like us to stop using the term risk behavior. I think, building on the success of that Siraj just explained, I think we can, you know, start to address other stigmatizing language that we all use because it's convenient or because it's a habit. And let's face it, you know, we talk about risk behavior. What is that? That's really people's sex. That's their sexual practices. It's really valuable to people, and you know, dismissing it as risk behavior is not the way to start a conversation about keeping ourselves safe. So let's try to give up the term risk behavior and use real words instead, like sex and sexual intercourse and desire and all of that.
Thanks, Bob. And you know, I'll append to that. You could argue that living is risk behavior. Walking out the door, getting out of bed is risk behavior. If you're not engaging in risk behavior, you're not living. So moving on, I'm kind of hogging there. So we'll move on to Gus for his marching order for today and the future.
Oh, Lord, yes, there's a little slogan. Love your community, learn from your community, ask them what they need, educate your community, and learn from them again.
That is gorgeous. It's almost like a poem.
And it's an iterative process.
Moving forward, Julie, marching order, as you head off into the wide world of thebody.com. And I know you're still with us. You need to
maybe she's headed off already, Jim.
Oh, I'm there. Am I here?
Yes, you are here now.
Okay. I've been thinking throughout the call about the beautiful vision and practice of working with love, and that part of that love includes really listening and understanding structural conditions and systemic oppression that can twin our love with fear. And how is it that we can love more safely and more boldly by acknowledging the fear inside ourselves, interpersonally and politically, that can set us in opposition to each other, to bring it out and to work to love it enough to overcome it.
I love that comment on love. It's gorgeous. And Siraj, for you're the finale. I will also, and we're down to the last couple of minutes, there is a final question that just came in that's directed to you. So if you want to answer the question quickly and then give us your idea of a marching order, this is coming from Michael. Is there any plan on the part of the CDC to include revision of, quote, unprotected language into data collected during counseling and testing procedures in order to develop surveillance data on prevention strategies other than condom use?
That's an interesting question. I'm actually not entirely sure, but we've actually talked about sort of the wholesale need to really kind of revise a lot of the survey instruments that CDC uses to collect that data. And the indication that I'm getting right now is that they're not immediately going to make any change. I think like that's something I could continue to discuss with them, simply because the cycle by which they publish these surveys and make them is sort of out of sync and already in the pipeline. So they probably cannot pull anything yet, but it's something that we're going to continue to really pressure them on.
Thank you for that. And your marching order, sir.
To everyone, thank you for being on this call, and I really want to invite everyone on this to really engage with the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance. We have so much momentum moving forward, and we want to really continue the success and really reflect the power of the community and really reflect the needs of the community when it comes to important HIV prevention strategies. And that are really kind of buttressed by a lot of the science that was explained by Gus and a lot of the amazing work that Jeff McConnell and his colleagues have done and how we can really truly change the prevention landscape. So I really invite everyone to engage with us at the HIV Prevention Justice Alliance.
And that is a beautiful way to wrap it up. Thank you, Siraj, to all of our presenters. Thank you, HIV PGA and Irma. Thank you again to AVAC for all your incredible support on these calls. Thank you to all of you for being here. This really has been a really incredible webinar. It's a rare webinar that kind of moves and touches you emotionally and gets your brain, the scientific part of your brain, buzzing all in the same piece. It was really getting the chills just thinking back to this call. So I really appreciate people being so honest and personal and really continuing to build on the really incredible legacy that Jeff left for us and really the marching orders he left for us to treat people like humans, to value pleasure, to value love, to ask questions, to understand what it all means as opposed to ticking off boxes. So thank you for all this. We will be sending out an email to all participants that will give you access to these slides and an audio recording once that recording is all pretty and cleaned up. So stay tuned for that. And stay tuned for future webinars from all these different partners, from ABAC, from HIV-PGA, and from IRMA. And until then, have a great day or the rest of your evening, and take care. Bye-bye.